Welcome to Designing Quality Initiative, Principles, Quality, Metrics, Public Reporting. I'm Jim Cerace, and I'm honored to serve as your moderator. The session Designing Quality Initiative, Principles, Quality, Metrics, and Public Reporting informs us that quality improvement does not occur incidentally, must be intentionally pursued. We will discuss principles of quality initiative development and relate them to quality metrics and public reporting of performance. I'd like to introduce our speaker. James Holley, MD, is the founder and the CEO of SETMA, LLP, a medium-sized multi-specialty group in Beaumont, Texas. His practice has customized NextGen into a robust disease management and population management tool, and his website, www.setma.com, contains all the electronic patient management tools which he has authored, as well as displaying the public reporting of quality metrics using HEDIS, AQA, NQF, PCPI, PQRI, etc. He has led his practice to apply for the NCQA recognition as a Tier 3 and AAAHC recognition as a PCMH. He is featured in the February 2010 Health Leaders magazine and is an innovator in medical informatics. Now please join me in extending a warm welcome to Dr. James Holley.
Thank you very much. I am accustomed to be a walker, and so I'm going to be tied to this microphone, and I apologize for that. But thank you for coming and taking your time. Hopefully by the end of this session you will judge that it's been valuable, but that will be your judgment. I have no real or apparent conflicts of interest to report, except my wife is angry with me right now, and there is a conflict there. But after 46 years, that's a joke. And these are the conflicts I don't have with anybody. The Southeast Texas Medical Associates, we founded in 1995. We began using EMR in 1999 and have done so ever since. We're going to describe how to define an organization-wide quality initiative. We're going to explain how to incorporate quality metrics in the planning, design, and execution of that initiative, discuss the differences between and the unique value of both process and outcomes quality metrics in quality improvement initiatives, and explain why to include public reporting by provider name as a part of the quality initiative, other than the fact you terrorize your partners. Identify why quality initiatives combined with public reporting empower an organization to change behavior of providers and patients. I do want to tell you that you need to know who I am, and I am IT VIP. Just want to make you give me due reverence and deference, but you don't know what a VIP is, do you? Because you think it's a very important person. A VIP is a village idiot personified. My practice will not give me the key to the server room. They will not give me the passport of the administration aspects of our IT deployment. We have 69 servers and 73 integrated software packages. We've spent over $6.5 million, all of it privately funded, but no grants or foundation money, and in developing IT. We've done a lot of interesting things, but it all started in 1999, because on January the 12th, 1999, I arrived at my office at 3 o'clock in the morning because we were starting that day. It was the second worst day of my life. By 7 o'clock that night, having not sat down, eaten, or gone to the restroom, I was exhausted, but we had survived the first day. 4 days later, we saw all of our patients on EMR without reducing our volume, and we continue to do so to this day. In May of that year, less than 4 months later, I suddenly realized that what we were doing was the wrong thing. If all we were going to gain from electronics is the ability to document a patient encounter, it was too expensive and it was too hard and it wasn't worth it. And we suddenly realized what we really want to do is electronic patient management. And based on Peter Senge's work in from MIT, that's documented in his book, The Fifth Discipline, we began developing disease management tools and electronic patient management, which is the foundation of our quality initiative solutions. The steps to selecting a quality initiative are really seven, and they're fairly generic, but I will go through them fairly quickly. You begin a new project while completing another. Quality is not something that you arrive at a stop sign and you say, ah, we've arrived at quality and we don't need to go any further. It's a continuing process. It's a direction in which you're going as much as it is a destination you're trying to reach. And so we're constantly thinking about new opportunities to improve and to find leverage points to improve what we're doing. Number two, you build upon your past work. A quality initiative is not something you pull out of the air and say, we're going to do this, but built on the logical extension of what you've done before. You leverage your resources to improve care. Number four is think about what you want to accomplish. If you shoot at nothing, you're liable to hit it. If you shoot for the stars and only hit the moon, that's not bad. Number five, examine your past work and ask if it has made a difference, because that's ultimately the goal, and we've talked about that extensively. Improving the quality of the care of our patients is the ultimate goal. We can have the greatest processes, the greatest plans and programs in the world, but if patients aren't getting better, it means nothing. Number six, develop an algorithm to electronically audit, to transform data to information. Numbers and names are of no consequence if it doesn't give you information from which you can leverage change. And finally, use the information to implement change that will make a difference. That's not an original concept with me. In the early 1990s, the IBM Corporation had some systemic challenges. And they hired some people they called change agents. And they developed five or six principles of change agency. And one of them was, if you're going to make a change, it better make a difference. And so it is the case with electronics and IT. Every time we determine to make a change, we want to make sure it's ultimately going to make a difference, not only for our providers, but also for our patients. Here's the first step, one and two. Begin the design of a new project while you're completing one. Build upon your past work and design a new function, which is a logical extension of what you've already done. These will contribute to success in many different ways. In April 2010, we completed a 14-month project to achieve NCQA and AAAHC medical home recognition. We were also completing an 18-month, two-phase business intelligence project, which was necessary for our medical home recognition. At the same time, we were developing a third phase to extend our business intelligence capabilities. And that's all going to become important to our further discussion as we talk about the settlement model of care and why it's important to be able to analyze what you do. Critical issues about quality metrics, which are going to be the foundation and really of quality improvement initiatives, is that we believe that a cluster is a seven or more quality metrics for a single condition. And the National Quality Forum, our practice is a member of NQF, and we really appreciate their work. But one of the quality metrics that they endorse is, did you take the blood pressure? Now, that's real exciting. That's kind of like, are you breathing? It doesn't ask, how did you take the blood pressure? Did you take it with both feet on the floor while the patient's sitting in a chair, or did you take it on the examination table? There's evidence-based medicine to suggest that taking it with both feet on the floor is going to give you a more accurate reading. It doesn't ask if you took the blood pressure after measuring the bicep and through an algorithm determine what size of cuff you should use and then documenting the size cuff you did use. But there's evidence-based medicine to suggest that that's a valuable way to improve the quality of the blood pressure results. It doesn't ask, did you repeat the blood pressure if it was elevated after a 10-minute rest? Because the normal response, the normal physiological response to exercise or stress is your blood pressure goes up. And for many of our patients, I do gerontology, and for many of our patients, a walk from the parking lot into our clinic is a stress, and their blood pressure is naturally going to be high. If you treat that blood pressure, you're going to have people falling and fainting and doing all sorts of interesting things. It's a normal physiological response for when you stand up, your blood pressure goes up. If it didn't, you would faint. There's just the way God designed us. Some of you believe that's the way that the monkeys decided it was going to be, but I believe God did it, but that's another discussion. But a cluster of metrics will make a difference. A single metric will not. And then there's galaxies of metrics, and that's galleries that are multiple clusters. And I want to illustrate this for you because it's really critical to our discussion. Here's what a cluster would look like. This is based on the Physician Consortium Performance Improvement Diabetes Measurement Set, PCPI. There are eight different metrics, and if you fulfill all these metrics, you will, in fact, begin changing the trajectory of your care of diabetes. We have a 12-year history of analytics on our treatment of diabetes, including standard deviations. In the year 2000, Our standard deviation was 1.98. If it were that today, I would not be telling you that because I'd be ashamed to tell it to you. It's dreadful. But as of today, our standard deviation is 1.2. Now, I'm still not really proud of that, but it's going in the right direction. I would like it to be closer to 0.8, which in a biological system is probably as good as it's going to get. But at least we're measuring it. We know that we're going in the right direction. And the last session was in this room on diversity and reducing disparities in ethnicity and other categories of care. We've been able to demonstrate that we have eliminated disparities of care among various ethnic groups, and we're very proud of that, and we can prove that by quantification. But a cluster is multiple metrics on a single condition. Now, a galaxy is multiple clusters tracked on a single patient at a single visit. Now, this is a patient that has six different conditions, and there are 61 quality metrics associated with that. I'm going to show you in a minute how we do this with a single patient at every visit and every encounter. We track over 250 quality metrics, and it's done intuitively, and we do it with every patient. We audit it and demonstrate that it's been done, and I'll tell you more about that in a moment. But remember clusters and galaxies. This is what's really going to change the quality of healthcare that we ultimately are able to produce. We've already said this, but a single metric will not change anything, but clusters and galaxies will. Our business intelligence project started in two phases. And the first phase was we wanted to be able to audit in real time a number of different quality metrics, those that are published by HEDIS, NQF, and some others, and I'll talk about those in a moment. And I want to tell you why. If you're going to be taking a test, and it's an open book test, and they'll give you the questions before the test, and there's no time limit on the test, why not cheat? Thank you. Why don't you look up the answers beforehand? You know, as a physician, I was always frustrated that I got these HEDIS numbers 2 years after the fact or 18 months after the fact, and quite frankly, I didn't much care. You know, you tell me what I did 2 years ago, I want to know what I'm doing today. And so we decided that if we're going to be held accountable for HEDIS, that we're going to first off find out what HEDIS really is, what it means, and what the content of it is, and then we're going to track it ourselves. And we're not going to track it every 2 years, we're going to track it every day on every patient. And so we have arranged for our providers to be able to see how they're doing with their HEDIS quality metrics at the point of care every time they see a patient. And so it is with a number of others. Now, here's the HEDIS, that's a healthcare effective data information set. It's what most insurance companies, about 90% of them, use to prove to their customers that their patients are getting a good job, getting a good care. Now, this is what's deployed in our EMR, and here's the legend, if you will. That which is in gray does not apply to this patient. That which is in black applies to this patient and has not been done. That which is in red applies to this patient. Applies to this patient and has been done. In red applies to this patient and has not been done. So with a single click of a single button, you can quickly assess whether you have done a good job. And typically we get providers to look at this after they finish treating the patient, and then they can quickly go back and complete something if it's not been done. But it's an easy way of knowing how you've done on your HEDIS. Now, the things in red need improvement. The blood pressure is not controlled, so we want it to be controlled. It helps with clinical inertia, the inclination of people not to change things. People don't like change, and even physicians don't like change in their patients' care, and they very often will neglect making that change. The National Quality Forum, and if you're going to be an NCQA Tier 3 medical home, you have to report on 10 quality initiatives. Well, we don't like small numbers, so we started doing 62 NQF-endorsed quality initiatives, and the same legend applies to this as did to others. And if I had a live database, I could show you what each of these means, because you click the view, and it'll tell you exactly what the elements of that measure is. Now, the Ambulatory Quality Care Alliance has a set of metrics, and there's somebody out there who's going to be smart enough to know that I'm pulling a rabbit out of a hat, because the AQA, which is a good organization, simply adopted the HEDIS from the NCQA, and these are identical. Thank you. Some people are nodding their head. I thought I'd just let you know I know that. We can say that we're doing HEDIS and AQA, but that we don't double that count in our number of quality metrics that we're assessing. The Physician Consortium Performance Improvement, one of the earliest groups that began to do quality metrics, has a diabetes measurement set. Remember, all this information is aggregated in the background. The provider sees the patient, treats the patient, assesses the patient, makes a plan for the patient, and then can click a button and see how he did. It's not our sheet. I think we have almost as many lady physicians as we do men. It's not that you're tracking in order to do these. You're then tutoring a patient to decide, did you do them? You'll see over here on the right-hand side where it says order hemoglobin A1C, if it's not been done, with a single click of a single button, you do three things. You order it, you send it to the lab, and you put it on the patient's chart. And it's very easy. One of our principles of building EMR and deploying data that we developed is we want to make it easier to do it right than not do it at all. We want it to be efficient and excellent. We want it to be easy for the provider because ultimately physicians are very, very busy as our nurse practitioners, and we have a number of those, and they're wonderful. My personal healthcare provider is a nurse practitioner, and the chief medical officer of our medical group, our multi-specialty medical group, is a nurse practitioner. He just happens to know more than anybody else. And the Physician Quality Reporting Initiative, you can do PQRI with two measures. We do seven clusters of measures. And once again, the same issue here. Black applies and has been done. Gray doesn't apply. And red applies and has not been done. So you can quickly assess whether you've done a good job or not. Now, it's like so many things. That which you have to remember, you very often forget. That which you don't have to forget, remember, you hardly ever forget. There's some of you old enough, so I'll ask the question. LSMFT. Does anybody know what that means? Yes, of course. Lucky strike means fine tobacco. Now, I hate tobacco. My father was a heavy smoker, and I have a war against the tobacco companies. But that was a jingle from the 50s. You haven't heard that in 50 years, but you couldn't forget it if you tried to. But I could ask you some other questions about critical issues that you long ago forgot, but there are things you need to remember. Well, what we try to do is make it not necessary to remember anything, and consequently you don't forget it. It works. Our business intelligence project included the tracking of all of these quality metrics. We wanted to analyze them at the point of care and at the time of care. We didn't want our providers to know how they did 2 years later, or 2 months later, 2 weeks, or 2 days. We want to know how they did that day. Now, the problem is with most EMRs, and ours is among the best. I'm not ashamed to say that. It's not an invitation to go buy it. It's simply that I believe it's good, and there are many other good ones. My goodness, there are 956 vendors out there. If I didn't have an EMR, I'd just go shoot myself. I don't know how you would go through that exhibit hall and not be depressed. But nonetheless, it's overwhelming, isn't it? I mean, face it, it really is. I mean, these are incredibly complex times that we're going through. But the business intelligence enables us to track these things daily. No matter how good your EMR is, you've got a database that has millions and millions and millions of data points. You know how long it takes you to audit something in that? How long it takes you to run an audit? With our system, it would take us 36 hours to run one of these reports. With our business intelligence software package, it takes us 10 seconds. The NCQA data set for qualification for diabetes recognition program is a complex set of data that involves 15 or 20 data points for every provider, including discriminators, including a summary of the scores as to whether those providers qualify or not. And because our business intelligence software does that, we can do that in less than 6 seconds and have it all displayed, and we can do it as often as we want to. We don't have to reapply for the diabetes recognition program for 3 more years. But we regularly, once a month, once a quarter, or once a year, it doesn't matter, we can do it every day, we deploy that to let our providers know where they are. And it's a great tool for changing behavior. There's nothing that encourages physicians to change their behavior like one thing: when the nurse practitioner is doing better than they are. It changes physician behavior. And I delight in publishing information with a doctor's name by it and information with a nurse practitioner's name by it when she does better than he does, and I know what he's going to do. He's going to go home that night and say, I'm going to change my way of living. We also have developed some audits. There is no nationally recognized audit for lipids. So we developed our own. I would love to spend a lot of time going through this. I don't have the time. It's really fascinating. This whole slide deck is published on our website at setma.com, along with all of our disease management tools and hundreds and hundreds of articles on public policy and EMR and all other kind of things that we've written about over the years. In addition to our public reporting, you can go up there and look up my name, and you can see how I treat hypertension and diabetes and all these other things. And so you can be sure that I'm going to be very careful that I take good care of patients, if not because I care about patients, which I do, at least so that you would think that I'm a nice guy if you look up my results. But the SETMA audit is, lipid audit is ours, and it gives us a lot of insight in how to take care of things and risk stratification and so on. We did, the PCPI has a published audit for stage 4 and 5 renal disease, but not for 1, 2, and 3. So we developed one for 1, 2, and 3. It seemed like the cow out of the barn, close the door, doesn't work. You want to close it before the cow goes out the barn. So that's the principle. In our business intelligence software package, and all of this is building up to how do you design a quality improvement initiative, is we want to look at how we examine various populations, ethnicities, socioeconomic groups, payer classes, age, gender, any way we can look to find a leverage point for improving the care that we give. And until you ask questions and get the answers, it's not because there's something unique or peculiar about an ethnicity, but we want to make sure that we're taking as good a care of somebody that belongs to a minority group as we would be somebody that belongs to a so-called majority group. And as a result, we look at these questions, and then we look at subsets of questions if we get the wrong answer to the first question, so we can start looking at things. Now, this is what our diabetes dashboard looks like. Here's financial class. You can see the self-pay patient, the ones in gold are the ones that are treated to goal, and the ones in purple are the ones not treated to goal. Now, I have to tell you that we became a Joslin Diabetes affiliate in August of this past year, the first multi-specialty group that's dominated by primary care to be so designated. They've always worked with pure endocrinology groups. And one of the things they've done is they've told us to lighten up, guys. We 6.5% hemoglobin A1C is our goal. They want us to go to 7.0, and we've agreed to do it. Wink, wink, nod. But this data is on 6.5, and we're going to do 7.0. And quite frankly, the medical literature supports that. But you can see here's the African Americans. Just you can see that 37.1% of them are not treated to goal. 31% are. With Caucasians, 64% are and 57% aren't. Those numbers are very close, and there's statistically not significant difference and disparity there. And you see the other groups, Hispanic, Asian, and others. We live in a fairly homogeneous population of Caucasians, African Americans with some Hispanics, though we're in Texas. The financial groups, you can see that we're taking better care of our HMO patients than some of our commercial insurance patients. But you see the self-pay patients have a problem. So one of the things we've done in the last 4 years, we've created the SETMA Foundation so that we can help pay for the care of our patients that can't afford it. And our partners in the last 15 months have given $1 million to the foundation. We've had some miracles of what we've been able to do with our patients who can't afford care. One lady was chronically ill with diabetes, always chronically ill. She had rotten teeth. Nobody's going to pay for her teeth. We found it from a dentist. It cost $10,500 to fix her teeth. I told him I wanted him to make a $4,000 contribution to our foundation, and I'd pay him $10,500 to fix her teeth. He did. I met her for the first time. That was 2 years ago, last week. I walked in an exam room, and this woman flew into my arms and hugging my neck and saying, "Oh, I love you, I love you." And I said, "Ma'am, I'm a little taken aback." You know, I thought she was being very pleasant, so I wasn't afraid. But I finally found out who she was. She was the lady whose teeth were fixed, and I'd never met her, didn't know her name. But it's really a fun way to practice medicine because we can make a huge difference in people's lives. But here we want to know how we're dealing with self-pay patients, how we're doing with Blue Cross Blue Shield, HMO, with Medicare, and so on. We actually have a lot more information than that. The business intelligence, it helps us analyze patients. One of the things that, here's another issue on chronic diabetes. You see the standard deviations here, the patients that are controlled, their mean is 6.1. Their standard deviation is 0.6. Those are not controlled. Their mean is 7.9, and the standard deviation is 1.5. We can improve their care, decrease in their mean, and these are based on 6.5 and not 7.0. Once those standard deviations start coming down, the means also will obviously drop, and the quality of improvement will obviously be reflected to be improved. We look at the frequency of visits. We wonder what's the difference. Are those that are not treated to gold seen less often? Are they tested less often? So we look at visit frequency. The control patients are seen 5 times a year. The not controlled are seen 3.9%. So that's a statistic, or 3.9 times. That's statistically significant. So one of the things we can do with patients that aren't treated to gold is start seeing them more often. 7 years ago, we went to our HMO and we said, we want a zero copay. They said, if you have a zero copay, you're going to be inundated with patients. They're going to cost them nothing to your clinic, and it's the most interesting visit of the day, so they come there for nothing. I said, we'll deal with that. In 7 years, we've had zero patients we had to deal with for inappropriately accessing our care, but we've also removed all financial barriers from that group to be able to see us in order to improve their care. You see how frequently hemoglobin A1Cs are tested. For the control group, it's 1.7 times a year. For the selected group, it's 3 times a year. So that doesn't seem to be an issue. The LDL testing and so on. You get the data, and then you start analyzing. You think about it. You ask yourself questions. And how do you determine what those questions are? We can do this because we started building 13 years ago, the disease management tools that give us all this discrete data. And then we build business intelligence software that analyzes that data, and we can ask ourselves all of these questions. Here's one thing that illustrates the principle of building. Building upon past work to look for a quality improvement initiative. In August of 2009, or June of 2009, PCPI published a care transitions quality metric set, and I'll show it to you in just a moment. When I saw it in June of 2009, because they sent me a copy, I realized we were doing all that, say, for one thing, because for 13 years, we've done discharge summaries from the hospital in our EMR. And so the patients get the discharge summary at the time of discharge, and we collected all this data, except for that one thing. And so we began doing this, and it was a quality improvement initiative that we began doing, which is built on our past work. And so we were able to leverage our resources in improving care and improving outcomes. Here's what that care transition audit looks like. 14 data points, 4 actions. And then everything in black has been done. Everything in red applies to the patient hasn't been done. So you see in this particular case, everything had been done. But if in fact it hadn't been, you have a button out here that you click a button, it takes you right back to the point of the discharge summary where you can complete that piece of information. And then the patients are given a written copy of their discharge summary with their reconciled medication list, with their follow-up care, with the provider name, address, phone number, time and date of the visit, and why they're to see that provider. All that's written down. They also have a follow-up call the following day. In the hospital care summary, down here at the bottom, you see here's the care transition summary. And then over here is a hospital follow-up call. That's clicked, and the provider schedules a call from our care coordination committee or department the following day, and they get a 12 to 30-minute phone call, not a 30-second phone call. And it is an engaging phone call. It saves lots of readmissions, and it makes certain that our patients are getting the quality of care, and it becomes a part of that care transition baton that we'll talk about in a moment. It's gotten such that we've changed the name of the discharge summary. You know, the discharge summary is kind of the stepchild in healthcare in the past because doctors finished it because they had to finish it to stay on staff, or they finished it because somebody was harassing them about wanting to bill the patient. Hospitals had held charges because, you know, you can't bill the insurance company until the discharge summary is complete because you have to have the discharge diagnoses. Well, ours are 99.6% completed at the time the patient leaves the hospital. And we realized that what we really wanted wasn't a discharge summary. We wanted a hospital care summary and a post-hospital plan of care and treatment plan. So that's a mouthful, but we changed our discharge summary, and they're now called hospital care summary, and post-hospital plan of care and treatment plan. And they're given to the patient. They tell that patient what we expect of them, what they expect of us, why we're there in the hospital, and what they need to do to take care of themselves and when all their follow-up care is, and a summary of their hospital discharge. Now, as we began a project based on that work, based on the transition of care auditing for the last 15 or 18 months, we are now entering into a very aggressive readmission attempt to decrease preventable readmissions by auditing our readmission rates, by looking at various issues. We look at financial class for readmissions. We look at socioeconomic groups for readmissions. We look at gender and ethnicity and age and all manners of things, looking for leverage points of where is it that we're dropping the ball and caring for patients so they end up back in the hospital. We look at length of stays. We want to know if patients are in observation. Are they more likely to be readmitted than somebody that hasn't been? 6 weeks ago, I was on call and saw our patients in one hospital on the weekend, and I discharged 29 patients that weekend. All of them had their care transitions, their hospital care summary and post-hospital plan of care and treatment plan completed. Their follow-up call was scheduled. All those things were done. But I wanted to find out, that's a pretty aggressive program of discharging 29 patients in 2 days by one provider. And so we've been tracking those patients for the last 6 weeks. And so far, there's been one readmitted for the same reason for which they were in the hospital. Three have been readmitted. Two were not. Would not be considered by anybody's definition of readmission, but there were new problems. The population we treat, the geriatric patients, are highly vulnerable and very fragile, and so they often get admitted for multiple reasons. Remember, our fourth issue of quality initiative development is to think through the process and determine what you want to ask of your data. And with the readmission process, that's exactly what we've done. We've done exactly what we want to know. Who is being readmitted? Why they're being readmitted? What could we have done to prevent it? Was it our fault? Was it the patient's fault? Was it the family's fault? Was it the communication fault? Where was the fault? Not for blame and not for a punitive reason, but trying to find ways, find a leverage point, some way we could stop this process from going forward. Remember, the fifth principle is examine whether or not we have done things in the past which may have already unknowingly reduced readmission rates. Because we want to know if we have, in fact, already started some things like the follow-up calls, and that was being done before. We already know that our readmission rates are about 7.2%, which is less than half of the national average. So we've already done a fairly good job, but it's still not where we want it to be. And so we're still going to ask these questions. The sixth principle, develop an algorithm based on the information gathered from the previous five steps to create an electronic audit. We want to know if we make a change, will it make a difference? If we do something for our patient, will it make a difference? That's the Faustian bargain we're going to make with our providers. If we ask you to make a change in your workflow, will it make a difference in the outcome? And the same thing we're going to do with our patients. If we ask you to make a change in your life, will it make a difference? And finally, be prepared to make changes based on the data. You know, this conference is a long one. I've been to a number of different sessions, and I have a list of things that I intend to do when I get home to make a difference and make a change, because we think that no conference is complete until you have made a change in something, somewhere, about something. Otherwise, it was a wasted conference, and certainly this one is not that at all. The next session is a next section. Once you go through quality metrics, once you go through asking yourself a lot of questions, what do you want to know? What inquiries do you make of your data? What information do you need in order to find those leverage points? The necessity of public reporting. I think it's time we're going to have to be transparent with our patients. We give our patients a plan of care and treatment plan that's a printed document. And it has listed on there the quality metrics that apply to them and the ones that have been fulfilled and those that have not, with a note saying, bring this to your next visit and tell your healthcare provider that you deserve and you require the following care and you'd like to have it done. We put ourselves on record and on notice that if these are evidence-based measures that are important for our patient's care, we want to engage the patient in becoming the referee, if you will, of their own healthcare. The And public reporting is a great way to deal with clinical inertia, the inclination of providers not to change things, and it occurs in academic medicine everywhere. One of the very largest and one of the most advanced groups in this country told me a year ago that clinical inertia is one of the most difficult things they deal with. And they would, if I named them, you would recognize them as a very prestigious and advanced and very greatly admired. And they deal with the same issue. The public reporting helps overcome that. I remember when I first told my partners we were going to start public reporting, they said, "Oh, really? Not by our name?" I said, "Yeah, by your name." And they, "Well, what if we're not doing a good job?" So you better change quickly because we're going to do it. And it was interesting. The initial anxiety and fear went away very quickly because they suddenly realized that degree of accountability was valuable to them. They all wanted to do a good job. I've never met a doctor who would admit anyway to not wanting to do a good job, or a nurse practitioner, either one. And it has made a very exciting change. The you can look at that at our website. This is that site. We put our patient satisfaction surveys up there. Now that's really gutsy because, you know, there's somebody here that says we are poor, 1%. We don't change it. It is what it is. The data is there. Now, you know, it shocks me, and I know it will shock you, to think that somebody might not think that I'm a wonderful person. But, you know, it happens from time to time. I can tell you so many wonderful stories. One guy who is now one of my dearest friends, 2 years ago, I was making rounds one weekend, and the nurses said, "That guy said the next doctor that walks in the room, he's going to kill him." And I said, "Does he have a gun?" They said, "We don't think so." I said, "Okay, let's go." And I said, I love seeing patients like that. But most often, it's bluster. But I was cautious when I walked in. I was ready to duck and let him get the nurse and not me. But I've been married for 46 years. I adore my wife. And I told her, I said, "If we ever get assaulted in public, you've got one responsibility." She said, "What's that?" I said, "Try to keep up. I don't have to outrun that bear. I just got to outrun you." But so it is what it is. And but it also gives our patients a degree of confidence that we're going to be honest with them. And transparency has its own set of values, because trust is the thing that's missing in healthcare today. You know what your patients trust in? They don't trust you. They trust MRIs and CAT scans and tests and whatever. That's why we're driving care out of the roof. I can examine a patient intellectually by asking questions, physically by doing a physical exam, tell them what's wrong with them, and say, "You know, we didn't do anything else. I'll see you back in 6 weeks. We'll see how you're doing," or 3 weeks, or whatever the interval appropriately is. But so many patients said, "Well, I want an MRI." If they trusted me the way I trusted Robert Seals, who was my family doctor when I was a child, who charged $1 for a visit, and $1 for a shot, and $1 for a prescription. He couldn't do much for us, but he loved us and cared about us, and we trusted him absolutely, and it didn't cost much. Today, the costs are astronomical. The trust is almost non-existent. And what we can do for patients is enormous. We can do more than we ever can do before if we can just restore that trust. And I think that's the whole genesis behind medical home, not only comprehensive care, not only coordinated care, but care where patients really trust us and believe that we have their best interests at heart. I've written several articles on entrepreneurism and professionalism because I think doctors have become entirely too entrepreneurial in their quest for finding new streams of revenue, is the phrase. All we need is find new streams of trust with our patients. Here's some of our National Quality Forum. You'll see that when I was preparing this, one of the complaints about HIMSS presentations is the data is old. You know, you'd have data from 3 years ago. Well, this is from January 1st, 2010 through December 31st, 2010. I could give you yesterday's data, but this is aggregated. Everything in red is out of place. But let's see what Holly's doing. Well, let's see, Holly. Dilated eye exam, 77.9%. What a sleaze bucket. I would not trust that guy. It should be 99%. It's a complex issue to document dilated eye examinations, although we have an ophthalmologist in our practice. And so we're working on that. We think it'll get better. These are diabetes. This has got to be above 60%. And then microstrip for protein in the urine, 92.3%. That's for NCQA, that's going to be above 80%. And then foot examination, Is that 85.6%? That's got to be above 80%. So you can see the data. Here's NCQA diabetes recognition. We've changed this because we're always changing things. We now place up here at the top, in the top row, the NCQA standards, and then in the right-hand column, we total what the scores each provider has. You've got to be above 75% to qualify for the diabetes recognition program, and all of our providers do. But it's there. All of the data is there. How many patient encounters they've had. We treat 7,136 patients with diabetes. And so treatment inertia is an issue. Quality improvement is an issue. But there's another problem with patient inertia. You know, how do you get patients to change their behavior? Well, we believe that one of the ways to do it is do something with them that's quantitative like we do with our providers. We publish their data out on the web. And so... one area we can do that in is with the Framingham Heart Study risk calculators. There are 12 calculators. The American Academy of Family Practice says that family physicians ought to calculate one of those every 5 years for their patients. We've calculated three of them for years for our patients at every visit. We decided a year ago to deploy all 12 of them, which we did. And then in our discussions with Joslin Diabetes Center, they ask, can you do what-if scenarios? And we said, no, but that's a great idea. So we designed the ability, and you see here, if all elements are to goal, the total points are 18. But if all their elements are to goal, it drops to 10. Relative heart age is 40, or the real heart age is 45 years. Relative heart age is greater than 80. This is a sick puppy. But if they're all the elements of the general cardiovascular 10-year risk is goes to goal, their relative heart age drops to 54. I can make a bargain with my patient saying, if you make this change, it will make this difference. It's a quantitative way of showing them that, and this is one of the greatest tools we use. Now, the problem with Framingham risk calculators is if you calculate these by paper, it takes about 25 minutes to calculate all 12 of them. If you do the what-if scenarios, it will add another 20 minutes to it. So 45 minutes, and which of us has that kind of time? Well, we deploy it electronically, and it takes us not an hour, not 20 minutes, not 10 minutes, not 2 minutes. It takes us 1 second. And we don't do this every 5 years. We do it every visit. And this is not kept in our computer on their plan of care and treatment plan. It's printed. And we say, here is your current relative cardiovascular risk. Here's what it is if you treat yourself to goal, or if you treat yourself to 20% of goal, or if you improve just your blood pressure. You know, one of the interesting things about this is it proves a data point that evidence-based medicine has proved to us for years. And that is that a patient with diabetes gets more benefit from improving their blood pressure than improving their blood sugar. Most physicians and people would say, oh, that's not true. Endocrinologists will say, that is true. Guess what the risk calculator says? It says that you get more benefit from improving your blood pressure than improving your blood sugar. Does that mean we shouldn't treat blood sugars? Absolutely not. It just lets you know that if you treat just the blood sugar and forget about the blood pressure, you're really doing your patient a disservice. But the bargain we can make with our patients, if you make this change, it will make this difference. Now, unfortunately, it's going to make a difference 20 years, 30 years, 40 years later. And that's why we need some quantitative way to keep before their eyes why they're making this change. Peter Senge in the Fifth Discipline talks about this as circular causality, where the point of time between the cause and the effect is so far that it's hard to see the association. There's no place that applies more than it does in healthcare. And so this is what we have to do with patients. They don't feel bad. They don't hurt. Why should I take this this care? We also do in our clinic the same thing we do in the hospital is we do follow-up calls for those patients that would benefit from it. I saw a lady in October, and I'm a brilliant diagnostician in addition to be a VIP in IT, and you can guess where I'm going when I say that. But her father had diabetes. Her mother had diabetes. Her brother had diabetes. Her two sisters had diabetes, and brilliant that I am, I thought, maybe she's got diabetes. I mean, yeah, is that good? I was so proud of myself. Lo and behold, she did. I called her the next morning at 7 a.m. I wanted to get a hold of her before she got off to work. I spent an engaging 45 minutes with her, explained to her in all my intellectual prowess and medical acumen how we were going to help her with an ADA endorsed diabetes education program, with medical nutrition therapy, with exercise therapy, with all these different things that we were going to do for her, and the medications we're going to start on, and when I was going to see her back. And she was so thankful and so grateful and so gracious and so pleasant. And as I hung up the phone, I thought, she ain't buying none of it. And so I created a follow-up telephone call for her. And I sent it with a three-day delay. About 12 years ago, I was trying to figure out how to do a tickler file so we could remember to do things with our patients. If they're going to do them in the next month or so, very few people forget. But it's beyond that, 3 months, 6 months, they almost always will forget. And so we want to find a way that we can make sure they have this care. Well, I was actually walking around a track, and, you know, your mind just doesn't stop. You constantly are thinking about this stuff. It's kind of addictive. And I realized Microsoft Outlook is embedded in our EMR, and it has a delay email function. And consequently, we can delay, we can type up all the information we want to get, delay the delay delivery for 3 days, 6 months, 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, doesn't matter. It sits on our server, and then suddenly when the date arrives, it pops up on our email and reminds us to do things. We have an extensive smoking cessation program, and we tell patients, we're going to call you in 1 month. You know what their used to be attitude was? Yeah, right. You're not going to call me in a month. Well, we've got an electronic tickler file with one click of one button. It's got their name saying, Mr. So-and-so, here's his phone number. Please call him and find out if he quit smoking. It goes on and on. And it's so easy to do. And they get shocked. And what happens is they end up quitting smoking because they first get a phone call and then they get an appointment to our 2x4 room, and that's where I beat them until they stop smoking. Oh, you think that's funny? Nobody I've ever beaten thought it's funny. But anyway, the whole business with patient inertia we can deal with data and information. Cardiometabolic risk, we do the same thing. Now, here's the way we finally deal. We have this poster framed in every public place in our clinic and in over 100 examination rooms in our three clinics, now four and soon to be five. And here's what it says. Firmly in the provider's hand, the baton, the care and treatment plan must be confidently and securely grasped. And the word grasp is important because it's intellectual. Do they understand it? And it's physical. Do they have it in hand? Grasped by the patient. If change is to make a difference, 8,760 hours a year. Remember, the most important number in healthcare today is 8,760. Because that's how many hours they're in a year. And if a patient gets lots and lots of health care, they're in the front of a provider about 12 hours a year. That means 8,748 hours. Guess who's in charge of their health care? They are. And if they don't get that baton, and they're not prepared to carry it, and remember, they can drop it, they can forget it, they can not be given it, or like that one patient in October 2010, she took it and flung it. She threw it as far away from her as she could get because she wasn't buying any of it. And so when we called her 3 days later, she said, I'm not doing that. If I need to know about diabetes, I'll ask my family. Everybody has diabetes. I don't think I'm sick. I'm not going to have a problem. And so there was a time in my practice, I've practiced for 37 years, that I said, yeah, right, honey. You know, you go find yourself somebody else to harass. I'm not going to take care of you. But that's not the medical home attitude. I wouldn't do that to my mother or my father or my brother, my sister, my wife, or my child. So why would I do it to my patient? And so we've been working with her, trying to help her to finally accept the fact that she has a disease that, though it's insidious and is slow in affecting her, it will ultimately hurt her severely, and then it'd be irreconcilable. And then this is the paper that they get about patient inertia, their cardiovascular risk, and what their risk changes and how it is affected and how it will make a difference in their lives. The SETMA model of care is built on performance tracking one patient at a time, performance auditing by a panel or population of patients, performance analysis by statistical analysis through the BI project, as is the auditing, public reporting by provider name, and quality assessment and performance improvement to look for leverage points to change those areas where the results are not what we want them to be. You remember the steps that we talked about, and I'll not read them back to you. Employing this model of care, together with the seven steps of selecting a quality initiative, will transform healthcare outcomes. And it has, and it does, and I recommend it to you. I would like to say so many more things to you, but I want to give a little bit of time for questions and answers if you have any. If you don't, I'll tell you a few other things, but I'll stop here and give you an opportunity to ask questions. If you are going to ask a question, if you'd go to the microphone so everybody can hear you. And if you don't have questions, I have more to tell you, and so you may want to ask a question to not be bored any longer. Are there any questions? Thank you. Thank you. Are there any other questions? Yes, sir.
How do the quality metric screens get provided to the provider? Are they clicked on within the EHR?
Yes.
And then can you talk about who created those? Are they built in the EHR? And the ones that are not actual standards, like your lipid profiles, how did you get those in?
Our EHR is totally customized. Everything we've done is our work. I would love to have had the opportunity to show you the actual setup, because it's really quite intuitive and easy to use. We have built all those in our medical home review template. We have all the quality metrics buttons there, so you can just click through them, and it takes a few seconds to see what you have and haven't done, and you can go back and do them, or you can do them at another time. Everything doesn't have to be done every time in order to do quality work. Our EMR vendor is actually at this point building our database into their system so that this kind of material can be available to anybody else. All this is on our website. Any vendor, any person can take it and deploy it in there. All the quality metric sets are published. As you know, content is the most difficult thing to build in an EMR, to have vetted, peer-reviewed. We built those the lipids and the renal 1, 2, and 3. We've asked NQF and PCPI to take those, review them, vet them, and then publish them, and we will see how soon and how quickly we can get those sorts of things done. Any other questions? Yes, sir.
Trying to think in terms of trying to get an organization to actually implement this kind of thing and take hold of it. Do you see any forms of rate of return, dollars that have been generated because you've followed this process, or cost savings, or in general types of quality of improvement that you've had that can be demonstrated to payers, that kind of thing?
Yes. You asked three different questions. I'll answer them. Obviously, I've already told you that we've got the data to demonstrate that our standard deviations improved from 1.98 to 1.2. It's hard to compare that with others because I don't know anybody else that's doing that kind of analysis. Our payers are very involved and very interested and very engaged. As far as return on investment, I told you we have invested $6.5 million. That's an accurate figure, perhaps on the low side, but certainly I can verify every dollar of that. That's all paid for. So obviously somehow we've done very well financially, or else we couldn't do that. We spent $500,000 on our BI program. That was paid for. The partners gave $1 million to the SEPMA Foundation. So financially, we're doing fine. We could not be doing what we're doing without the EMR. I remember when we bought EMR in 1998, our accountant and everybody said, "Y'all are the biggest fools we've ever seen in the world. That's the dumbest thing I've ever heard. It has nothing to do with patient care, and you've just wasted your money. You're probably all going to go bankrupt." And in May of 1999, I thought we were. I didn't think we could make it. We did, and the rest is history. We could not be doing what we're doing today. Some people would say that we're dreamers. Others would say we're hallucinators. But we continue to think and build. And And now my partners have suddenly, you know, with things like the Davies Award and the Stories of Success and the Office of National Coordinator just named us as one of 30 exemplary practices in the nation for clinical decision support. PCPCC has published a report at the end of March naming us as exemplary practice and on and on. They've now, rather than pulling and pushing and having to hammer them, they're now saying, can we do this? Can we do that? And they're coming up with all these wonderful ideas. And so the synergy, the energy, the generative, the creative energy has now taken place for us, and you couldn't stop it if you tried. So I think that's what has to happen. And ultimately, that's what's going to transform healthcare. You know, reform is pressure from the outside to try to squeeze you into a mold. And that will only be sustained as long as the pressure is applied. The elasticity of the organism will be such that once the pressure goes out, it goes back to where it was before. But you couldn't stop our practice. Nobody pays us for medical home. Nobody pays us for the quality metrics. Nobody pays us for all the things that we do. But we don't do them because of money. We just have to make enough money to keep the doors open. And I don't want to sound like Mother Teresa, because we make a good living. We manage our cash very well. We're good business people as far as making sure we know who we owe, when we owe, and it's short-term debt for rent and that sort of thing, because we don't owe anybody long-term debt. We for the last 9 years have had a $2 million line of credit. And I found out the other day that it had been canceled because we just had forgotten to renew it. It had been so long since we had ever used it. But I think what happens is you give people a vision. You know, I believe that process only produces outcomes when process is internalized as a personal passion. And when that happens, you can't stop it. You know, you can measure it and audit it and you can pressure it. And I love to harass and aggravate my partners with new concepts and new ideas. But ultimately, until they internalize it, until it becomes a part of their soul, a part of their persona, a part of their superego, if you want to be Freudian about it, it will not be sustained. But once that happens, the government doesn't have to pay for it. No insurance company has to pay for it. It just happens. It just goes on and on. It takes on a life of its own. And that's what happens with quality. Quality becomes a way of life. You just constantly think that we can think of more things to do than we have time, energy, and resources to do, which is not a bad thing. Any other questions? Yes, sir.
You talked about building quality in steps and building on your past experiences, but can you give a little bit of a guideline on people who are just at the start of the road? You know, what would be the first step and
good.
How you go from there?
Okay, excellent. Where do you start on the road to building quality? I think first half you had to build the functionality in the EMR to display data in an intuitive way so that it will drive people to make right decisions. And then from that, you can start building quality. I choose one quality metric. Diabetes is a great one. You know, there are 7 distinctive and all different quality metrics published on diabetes. NQF has one, NCQA has one, Joslin has one, PQRI has one, PCPI has one, HEDIS has one, AQA has one. You know, those are the same though. And there's one other. And they're all different. I put them all in a spreadsheet and wrote letters to all these people and talked to them on the phone and said, hey guys, let's get together. There's no contradictions here and they're all good, but let's make one. We track all 7 just because, you know, did I hear OC? No, I'm not obsessing quality, but we just want to do a good job. So that's where I would start. Build the tools to do a good job. And then build the tools to measure whether you're doing a good job. The quality metrics follows the performance. Yes, ma'am.
I'm really envious because PCMH really depends on a care team. How do you instill that kind of passion in other members of the care team that are not the direct clinician? And what role do they have with regard to the documentation?
Thank you. I so appreciate the question, because our nurses and our nurse assistants and all of our staff are so engaged. They are so enthusiastic. One of the things we do is we reward the nurses and the support staff and not the providers for outstanding performance, because we know the most of the results comes from their work and not from the doctor's work. When you're looking at quality initiatives, the people that are really going to make it or break it are the nurses, the nurse assistants, the nurse aides, the unit clerks, and those other people that support us in what we do. And so they get very enthusiastic about it. If their provider is the top performer, they get a reward, not the provider. And I think I can influence nurses more than I can influence doctors. You will discover very quickly. In many ways, I don't have a lot of respect for a lot of doctors because they've become so preoccupied with how much money they're going to make and are they going to make enough money and all those other things. They've almost sometimes forgotten who they are. I've seen that change in our organization, but it's the heart of it, where they spend a lot more time worrying about their money than they do about their patients. But our nurses still have a real passion and vision. So it's not been a problem to get them engaged. We teach them we spend a half a day a month with the nurses alone. We close the clinic. We spend a half a day alone with our providers and training them, teaching them, giving them the vision. And once they get it, once again, it's that generative internal drive that you couldn't stop it. And it's really fun to watch because they really get engaged. And so that team effect is really important. Plus, they see how we treat people. You know, when you come to SETMA, The Medicaid assistant director of the state Medicaid came down a few years ago, and he said, I'm here to find out why it's costing us half of what we expected to cost for you to take care of our Medicaid patients. And their question was, are we under-treating? Are we denying care? Are we not limiting? I said, we've got a waiting list for mothers that want us to treat their children. We treat them with respect and dignity, and they're honored guests in our practice and not just people that we are going to put through a Medicaid mill. We want them to do well. We want those children to be like my 8 grandchildren. Have I mentioned I have 8 grandchildren? But I want them to have the same blessings, the same benefits, the same future as my grandchildren. And I'll do a lot to try to make that happen. And so the team approach is really an awesome thing when you see it really happening. And we have nurses in the hospital and nurse practitioners in the hospital who do a fabulous job. And so if I had to give one group credit for what we do, it wouldn't be me and it wouldn't be our doctors. It's our nurses, our nurse assistants, our unit clerks, because they really are a grand part of our team.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, ma'am. Any other questions? I have just another minute or so. I want to tell you a quick story. It's our medical home poster child. I saw a man in the hospital a little over 2 years ago, angry, hostile, mean, hateful, bitter. He was one of my partner's patients, but I was on call on the weekend. And I saw him on Saturday, and I couldn't get him out of it. I can joke anybody out of anything, you know, pat him and do whatever. He wasn't buying it. Next day, he wasn't buying it. And he was ready to be discharged. I did. I said, I want to see you in my office. I saw him, and he was still angry, bitter, mean, hateful, hostile. I discovered in the course of that follow-up visit that he was disabled, truly disabled, because of his diabetes. He was losing his sight, going blind. He was depressed, and that's where his anger was coming. Couldn't afford 5 of his 9 medications. He couldn't afford gasoline to come to the doctor. He couldn't afford the copays to come to diabetic education. He couldn't afford to see an eye specialist. He had no insurance. He left that day with a gas card from our foundation, with us having paid for his medications. We have for the last 2 years, $2,600 a quarter for his medications. He left with the instructions and understanding and help with how to apply for disability, with an appointment to a ophthalmology research program in Houston where they would treat him free to preserve his vision, with a waiver of the copays for the diabetes education program. He came back 6 weeks later, and for the first time in 10 years, his diabetes was treated to goal. But more than that, he walked in with something I could not prescribe and I could not give him. He had hope. I'm telling you, I could almost shed tears talking about this guy because he was transformed. I mean, you want to talk about transformation of healthcare. This guy was transformed. He was happy. He was jolly. You know why? Because he said, for the first time in 10 years, I believe there's life after diabetes. And his diabetes was treated to gold. And he's been a delightful person to take care of ever since. And he now has disability, and it's been 2 years, so he now has insurance, and we can stop paying those fees. But I'll tell you, that's the best money we've ever invested. He's our poster child. And I tell him, I talk about him all over the country. And he just smiles because he came in about 18 months after all this, and he was a little bit down. I said, what's wrong? He said, I'm just afraid. I said, what are you afraid of? He said, I'm afraid that you're going to get tired of supporting me and helping me. I said, how can I get tired? You're part of our family. You're part of our home. This is called a medical home, and that's not a name. That's a function. That's a dynamic. That's a force of nature, if you will. And he smiled and he said, I'm so glad to hear that. And, you know, guys, I'm telling you, this is a wonderful time to be in medicine. It's a wonderful time to practice medicine. And no matter what your circumstances are, they're different than ours. We've been really blessed. I believe that blessing comes from God. We've worked hard, but we've got... We have been able to do some things that maybe you can't do. But I'll remind you this. Don't worry about what we're doing. Just celebrate what you're doing. Celebrate little things. In 1999, in May, my co-founding partner, who's now dead from pancreatic cancer, a dear man, he was down in the dumps. He was so depressed. He said, we're not even crawling yet. I said, you're probably right. But I said, you know, we've at least started. I said, when Dylan, your oldest son, first turned over in bed, did you holler and say, Linnell, this retarded cerebral palsy, idiot kid of ours can't even crawl, he's just turned over in bed? Or did you shout and say, Linnell, come look, Dylan turned over in bed? And he smiled. I said, you see, you celebrated his turning over in bed. Now, if he's 25 years old and all he's doing is turn over in bed, you got a problem. I said, if a year from now all we're doing is what we're doing currently, I will join your lamentation, but today I'm going to celebrate that we've gotten started. And a year from now, I hope that we're doing more to celebrate. And so we developed the celebratory attitude. And you could take somebody and show me that they're doing things so much unfathomable than we are. And I would be delighted with that and continue to celebrate what we're doing. So I'm telling you, celebrate what you're doing. Delight in what you're doing. Be challenged by other people. Be encouraged and be instructed and be guided by other people. But celebrate what you're doing. And you will also come with a story of success that will be remarkable. Thank you very much for coming.